paying nearly $120 million in school bonds this year alone.
Lawmakers vote to halt the state's school bond program. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, April 1st. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new study shows polar bears can't likely adapt to a land-based diet as sea ice retreats.
You have to keep in mind that for grizzly bears, those that live in the Arctic are the smallest of their species and they occur at the lowest density.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Join Alaska Public Media and participate in our statewide live online social screening and chat about the film The Home Stretch, Friday, April 17th from 12 to 1 p.m. Be part of the conversation about homeless teens in our communities. More at alaskapublic.org. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer in the United States and often has no symptoms. If you are 50 or older, talk with your doctor about colon screening today. Learn more at alaskacolonhealth.org. This message sponsored by Ride for Life.
A federal revenue sharing program called Secure Rural Schools has been a million-dollar boon to some Alaska cities and boroughs, mostly in Southeast. Despite the name, the money doesn't just go to schools, and these days it's not at all secure. But as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, a two-year extension of Secure Rural Schools has advanced in Congress.
The extension was tacked onto a bill on an unrelated subject, Medicare funding, the so-called Doc Fix bill. The U.S. House passed the bill last week. The Senate is likely to take it up next week. National Association of Counties spokesman Brian Namey says he's optimistic. Municipalities and school districts in 41 states depend on their SRS money, not only for education, but also for roads and emergency services. Namey says that creates a broad base of support.
Well, our allies on Capitol Hill are hearing this call from boroughs across Alaska and counties across the country that these programs need to be reauthorized and fully funded.
Secure Rural Schools grew out of a 1908 law that gave local governments 25% of federal timber receipts from nearby forests. But then in the 1990s, the national timber harvest declined dramatically. So Congress created a new program to base payments on what a community's harvest used to be. Last year, Alaska communities got $14 million from it, but the program expired at the end of the fiscal year. Its extension seems to have hitched a good ride with the Medicare Doc Fix bill. The vote in the House was overwhelming, President Obama supports it, and senators are under a lot of pressure to pass it. But opposition is growing, particularly from deficit hawks. The free market advocacy group Club for Growth, for instance, wants to stop the Doc Fix, and it's warning lawmakers their vote on the bill will be part of their annual scorecard. Club for Growth spokesman Doug Sackleben says the bill is an expensive package.
The issue for us was not only do you lump a lot of stuff together in one bill, but you do it without offsetting $100+ billion.
Club for Growth doesn't have a position on Secure Rural Schools itself, but Sackleben is skeptical of the House approach.
If it's a worthwhile, important issue, it ought to have the merit to be debated by senators. Instead of being put into a bill that's predominantly intended to be a Medicare reimbursement rate bill.
In Alaska, borough managers like Steve Giesbrecht of Petersburg aren't sure they can rely on Secure Rural Schools money. Petersburg, with a population of just over 3,000, is one of a handful of Alaska communities that have reaped more than $1 million a year from SRS. Giesbrecht says he's not counting on it continuing.
What we heard when we were in D.C. Related to Secure Rural Schools was Secure Rural Schools is going to go away. We may get an extension or two and a wind down, but there's just not a lot of support for it.
Giesbrecht says the borough has saved much of its SRS money in a school's savings account, so losing the payments won't cause an immediate crisis. But at the same time, the state is slashing its spending, and another federal program that funds local governments, PILT, or Payment in Lieu of Taxes, is in jeopardy. Giesbrecht says he's working to launch a community dialogue on the tough choices ahead for Petersburg. With help from Joe Wicknicki in Petersburg, I'm Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C.
The Senate Finance Committee has included in its version of the state budget language rejecting pay raises included in contracts for more than a dozen units for the upcoming fiscal year. The committee also adopted language removing salary increases for employees not covered by unions. Committee co-chair Pete Kelly said that action would require separate legislation. Such legislation was introduced in the House today. Kelly says the move is geared towards saving jobs. Documents provided at the hearing show removing the salary increases would save about $57 million. Senator Click Bishop, a former state labor commissioner, said afterward that he did not support the amendments. The legislature has passed a bill that would put its school bond reimbursement program on hiatus. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reports that the big question is whether it will affect Anchorage's $60 million bonding proposition.
Right now, when municipalities bond for school construction costs, the state pays more than half the bill.
We're paying nearly $120 million in school bonds this year alone.
Representative Steve Thompson, a Fairbanks Republican, carried a bill that would stop the program for 5 years and only bring it back with a reduced reimbursement rate. With Alaska facing a multi-billion dollar deficit, Thompson said it was not appropriate for the state to automatically take on more financial obligations.
We are simply trying to control our debt.
Debate over the bill focused on two things, money and timing. Representative Sam Keto, a Juneau Democrat, opposed it, saying the legislation could create larger deferred maintenance costs.
By taking a holiday, these costs aren't going to go away. The costs are still going to be there. They're just going to be delayed, and it's going to cost us more when we come to that point where we actually have to fund those projects again.
Anchorage Republican Liz Vasquez said she thought the bill had merit in principle, but that she disliked the process around it. The way the bill is written, it would go into effect retroactively, closing the program to new school bonds issued after January 1st of this year. That would block Anchorage from getting funding for the school bonding proposition being considered in the April 7th election.
Whether it's the IRS, whether it's another governmental agency, I detest any government agency or group that decides retroactively to change its rules.
Representative Lance Pruitt, another Anchorage Republican, sympathized with this point.
I come from Anchorage, and I will recognize this is really difficult because some of the individuals in my community, yes, they are currently making some of these decisions on whether or not to go forward with this bond.
But Pruitt then stressed that the state could not delay an action on the program given the revenue shortfall. He compared the state to a bird that kept flying into a window of his home until it killed itself.
This is the appropriate time to step back, to reevaluate the program, to come back with one that makes sense, and stop running into that virtual window.
The House passed the bill with a 23-15 vote on Wednesday afternoon. Anchorage Republican Liz Vasquez and Dillingham Democrat Bryce Edgman joined the minority caucus in opposition to the bill. But in a complicated procedural move, the provision to retroactively apply the bill to the Anchorage election failed. With a 24-14 vote, the House did not reach the two-thirds threshold needed to change the date when the bill goes into effect. Representatives will come back on Thursday to reconsider the bill and, once more, take up that provision. If it fails again, the legislation will go into effect 90 days after it is signed into law, and the Anchorage school bonds will be the last ones to be included in the reimbursement program. The bill has already passed the Senate. In Juneau, I'm Alexandra Gutierrez.
Governor Walker's Medicaid expansion bill has passed its first committee in the House. HB 148 was approved by the House Health and Social Services Committee last night with a 6-1 vote. The bill would allow the state to accept at least $145 million in federal funds to provide health insurance to low-income, childless adults. The federal government is funding 100% of expansion until the end of 2016. Then the match gradually decreases to 90%. In 2020. Four Republican lawmakers voted for it, but not Liz Vasquez. The Anchorage Republican says the committee didn't hear enough expert testimony on how Medicaid expansion would impact the state budget.
Yes, we have public comments, and those are useful, but we have not vetted these issues sufficiently. And shame on us for passing a piece of legislation that is basically an octopus.
Vasquez calls the bill irresponsible. Fairbanks Democrat Adam Wohl says nearly 30 states have already expanded Medicaid and have seen an economic boost. He says beyond the economic argument, it's important to give Alaskans who can't afford insurance peace of mind.
Someone that came in on Saturday brought up something that I hadn't heard yet, and it was empowerment. And he mentioned that the empowerment you get when you have the security of having insurance, and I can speak to that because I went for many years without insurance.
The bill next goes to the House Finance Committee. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an extreme athlete from Juneau talks about how he got his start.
When I was a senior in high school, a guy rolled through the town offering tandem skydiving, and I was his first client.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Rural Energy Enterprises, supplying dealers throughout Alaska with fuel-efficient Toyo stoves and Oil Miser water heaters for more than 28 years. Local dealers can be found at rural-energy.com.
As sea ice continues to retreat and polar bears spend more time on shore, one question lingers. Can the world's largest species of bears survive on land-based food? A new study says no. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
Arctic sea ice this year covered about 500,000 square miles less than average and started its retreat 2 weeks earlier than in past years. The earlier the ice retreats, the earlier polar bears will come ashore, which means they are spending more time on land.
It's changed by about a week, a decade in Western Hudson Bay.
That's Karen Rode. She's a research wildlife biologist for the U.S. Geological Survey and the lead author on the study. A polar bear's diet normally consists entirely of fatty, energy-dense foods like seals and occasionally a whale carcass. But Rhodes says as bears spend more time on land, some have been observed eating terrestrial foods.
The observations of polar bears eating bird eggs have been limited to 30 or fewer individuals, and polar bear populations are somewhere between 900 and 2,000 individuals. So it's a really small proportion of any population that's eating some of these higher quality terrestrial foods.
Other foods like berries and plants are also available, but according to Stephen Amstrup, the chief scientist at Polar Bears International and a co-author of the study, those foods provide little nutritional value to the bears.
We know that in the human case, you give a lot more nutritional benefit if you eat a big hunk of steak than if you eat a few sprigs of celery. They may take up the same amount of room in your gut, but the nutritional contribution to your welfare is very different.
Another factor that comes into play is competition with other predators like Arctic grizzly bears for a limited supply of food. Amstrup says the grizzly bears would likely fare much better on these land-based foods because they have spent millennia adapting to those conditions.
And so they are poised to take advantage of the foods that are already there and are evolved to do so. Polar bears, on the other hand, would be, if they were forced ashore and attempting to take advantage of the terrestrial foods, they would be learning how to do it.
Karen Rhodes says the difference in body size also puts polar bears at a disadvantage on shore. They are much larger and require more food than the smaller grizzlies.
You have to keep in mind that for grizzly bears, those that live in the Arctic are the smallest of their species, and they occur at the lowest density, and studies show that those populations are limited by food availability. So polar bears are entering that kind of environment where the bears that occupy the habitat are half their size.
Rhodes says the Western Hudson Bay polar bear population is where the most terrestrial feeding has been observed. But population declines and lower survival rates in years bears spend more time on shore continue, despite the consumption of land-based foods. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
A new report from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration shows a slight increase in the Cook Inlet beluga whale population. But as KDLL's Shailen Cochran reports, the genetically distinct whales haven't bounced back as fast as scientists hoped.
The latest survey from June of last year showed 340 Cook Inlet beluga whales, more than the 312 that were counted during the last survey in 2012, but still not as many as researchers would like to see.
It hasn't declined drastically, but it also hasn't begun to recover, which is, I think, an issue of concern.
That is Dr. Rod Hobbs. He's a research biologist working out of Seattle, and you'll find his name on about two decades worth of Cook Inlet beluga abundance studies. Unsustainable subsistence harvests from the 90s have been pointed to as the main culprit in the population drop-off, and Hobbs says tighter regulations since 2005 seem to have helped curb the decline at least a little.
And the population at the end of the period of unrestricted hunting was around 350 whales, and it has not increased from that.
He says they expected a rebound after the hunt was closed, but that hasn't happened. And in fact, a gradual decline has continued, averaging about 1% a year.
And when we project the population into the future using a fairly complicated population model, it appears that there is a significant risk of that population going extinct.
So there are clearly other variables posing a risk to the beluga populations. It's not all due to overhunting. But what those other risks are, well, they're still working on it. A recovery outline was put together in 2010 as part of the endangered species listing. It named four threats to belugas: overharvest, killer whales, mass strandings, and the big one, anthropogenic noise from coastal development in Cook Inlet. That could be making it more difficult for the whales to communicate and, by extension, survive. Hobbs says Cook Inlet is a pretty noisy place to begin with, but it's only gotten louder the past few years with a dramatic uptick in oil and gas development. NOAA and the National Marine Fisheries Service have spent several years working on a final recovery plan. It's going through internal reviews right now and should be released by this summer. In Kenai, I'm Shailen Cochran.
Judges in Alaska have the option to send minors to youth court for sentencing, where the bailiffs, attorneys, and judges are also their peers. Branches from across Alaska flew into Kodiak last week for the 20th annual United Youth Courts of Alaska Conference. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche has more.
In Alaska, some minors may face their classmates when being sentenced for misdemeanors and crimes. Youth court students issue sentences to fellow students who have committed either status offenses like possession of tobacco or crimes like theft. Deborah Petenga is a senior at Kodiak High School and the vice president of the Kodiak Teen Court Bar and the board. She says community service is one possible sentence.
We also give them essays, and some creative ones is creating a PowerPoint or doing a research about the negative effects of a marijuana or other drugs with the body. Like for stealing, we could like research on how stealing could affect the economy of the town or something like that.
Youth court students learn about creative sentencing as part of their training at the annual Youth Court Conference. They fly to a different location every year, and this time they chose Kodiak. Students meet for two whole days of speeches and forums designed to inform and educate them about the court system and the young people they sentence. Among the forums this year are The Youth Brain, Creative Sentence, and Restorative Justice. Darlene Turner is the program manager for Kodiak Teen Court. She says that the key phrase is restorative justice as opposed to punitive justice.
There's not just the consequences, but competency development so that the person is being educated, not just them, but their parents.
She says youth attorneys communicate with the offenders' families. One of the forums this year is Parenting with Love and Limits, where students learn how to speak with families and suggest solutions, like a counseling program. One of the vital skills youth court members take away from their lectures is a fine-tuned understanding of the offenders and their situations. And Turner says that it's very appropriate for young people to sentence their peers.
Youth listen to youth much better. They speak to each other better. So a lot of times a youth offender will certainly talk to their attorneys and tell them things that they would never tell you or me.
Turner says that students also learn to be leaders.
The more you empower a youth to do something, the more they achieve.
The youth court changes the students on both sides of the case. Eli Heinrich from Kenai is in his fourth year of youth court. He says that the greatest benefit is the effect the court has on the young offenders.
It's kind of a system that gives kids a second chance with the record and the effects of what they've done wrong, which is probably the best aspect of youth court. It keeps them out of the adult court. It keeps the misdemeanor off their record.
Youth court students had a chance to exchange those thoughts at this weekend's conference. In Kodiak, I'm Kayla DeRoche.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Premier Dental Group. Smiles for Life is an annual campaign going on now through June for seriously ill, disabled, and underprivileged children. More at smilealaska.com. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit alaskaquitline.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
A report on a fatal avalanche near Cantwell last month says the victim and other snow machiners underestimated the snow slide potential. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
Russell Miller of Anchorage triggered the March 14th slide that killed him while riding his snow machine across a cut bank in the Squaw Creek drainage off the park's highway. It's an area that Alaska avalanche expert Wendy Wagner says might not appear to be dangerous.
They were in meadows. They weren't in big mountains by any means.
Wagner directs the Chugach National Forest Avalanche Center, which prepared the report on the Cantwell area slide.
Avalanche terrain can be really small features. It doesn't have to be a big, wide open slope.
The victim, Miller, was buried but ultimately dug from the snow by other riders, only some of whom had rescue gear. Another takeaway from the accident Wagner points to.
Always have your avalanche rescue gear with you. This is a shovel, a beacon, and a probe. It's three essential items.
Miller was an experienced backcountry rider and was wearing an avalanche beacon plus an airbag designed to float the wearer to the top of a slide. But Wagner says the airbag was not armed.
So the pull cord was dashed inside the bag itself.
The report says it took between 20 and 30 minutes to find and dig Miller out of the avalanche debris, by which time he was not breathing. Fellow riders and later emergency responders administered CPR and got Miller breathing before he was transported by helicopter to an Anchorage hospital. He died of injuries suffered in the avalanche 4 days later. In Fairbanks, Dan Bross.
Jean DeVore started skiing and skydiving as a kid growing up in Juneau. Now he skydives, speed rides, and performs Hollywood stunts for a living. KTOO's Lisa Fu reports on how a former Juneau kid turned his passion into a profession.
Jean DeVore stars in The Unrideables, Alaska Range.
I have spent my whole life waiting for this moment. An opportunity to pioneer and ski mountains that were previously thought unrideable.
Unrideables is a documentary on speed riding, a combination of big mountain skiing and high-speed parachute flying. In the film, DeVore literally flies off snowy cliffs, flips downward, and makes aggressive ski turns. The 39-year-old grew up in Juneau.
If you didn't get outside and do something, you'd go crazy living here. And as a kid, whether it was scuba diving, skiing, kayaking, climbing, like I went out and did everything that this beautiful area offers.
He started skiing Eagle Crest Ski Area at age 5, and as a young adult, spent summers river raft guiding. His first time skydiving was in Juneau.
When I was a senior in high school, a guy rolled through the town offering tandem skydiving, and I was his first client.
After that, DeVore was hooked. He moved to Arizona in 1995 to pursue skydiving full-time. He became part of a group that was perfecting what was at the time a new style of skydiving, free flying.
Most people think skydiving is belly to earth, falling flat Well, we were taking it into three dimensions, whether we were standing up vertically and having our feet go first or going head down towards the earth or everything in the middle.
DeVore worked as a skydive coach and competed in world skydiving meets. After a little while,
the world of Hollywood and the stunt world started calling.
He coordinates, films, and performs aerial stunts.
We did all the wingsuit scenes in Transformers 3, where we were flying our wingsuits through downtown Chicago, through all the buildings, having the robots chase us.
In his 20-year career, DeVore only recently experienced his first injury, a torn ACL. But he says he's had close calls. During a movie shoot in New Zealand, DeVore was supposed to jump out of a helicopter, land on a big mountain, cut off his parachute, and ski down. He had been practicing for weeks, but while filming,
my parachute didn't open. My lines came out, and they tied around my ski boots and my bindings. So I basically tied myself up in the sky, and my parachute never inflated. It was just being towed like a piece of garbage. And I took that all the way into the ground and impacted at probably 95, 100 miles an hour, you know, almost pure free fall speed.
DeVore was positive he was going to die. All he could think about was his wife. He curled up his body and hit the ground on his back.
2 minutes later, I stood up and didn't have a broken bone, zero injuries, nothing.
The mountain he landed on was part of the Invincible Snowfields. Despite the close calls, DeVore loves what he does and is sticking with it for as long as he can. He has friends in their late 60s and early 70s still skydiving. He says he may one day bring the sport back to Juneau and, just maybe, change some kids' life. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
Five Western Alaska athletes will make their way to Greenland next year after earning spots on Team Alaska for the 2016 Arctic Winter Games at the Western Interior Cross Country Ski and Biathlon Championships. Skiers and biathletes from across Western Alaska and the interior gathered in White Mountain late last week for the event. Nome's Bianca Trowbridge won the biathlon. Trowbridge and her coach Keith Conger say it took a season of intense training that paid off.
At the beginning of the season, I had a goal, and it was to make it to Arctic Winter Games, and I worked as much as I could to get there.
Increased her training, you know, 3-4-fold from the past, had a determination that I've never had in any other athlete that I've ever coached. She was as motivated as I've ever seen. Her goal was to be number one in the biathlon in the rural state of Alaska, and she achieved that goal and has a ticket now to go to Greenland as a ski biathlon.
The Arctic Winter Games begin March 6th, 2016 in Nuuk, Greenland. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shaylin Cochran in Kenai, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Lisa Fu in Juneau, and Matthew Smith in Nome. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. Alaska Pacific University emphasizes teaching and research that engages the region's social, cultural, environmental, and geopolitical issues. The university's Early Honors Program attracts academically advanced high school students who complete their senior year credits while also earning college credits as full-time APU students. This message sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.